Welcome to the SEI podcast series, a production of the Carnegie Mellon University Software Engineering Institute. The SEI is a federally funded research and development center sponsored by the U.S. Department of Defense and operated by Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. A transcript of today's podcast is posted on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts. My name is Suzanne Miller. I'm a principal researcher here at the SEI, and today I'm very pleased to introduce you to Ian Gorton, a senior member of the technical staff at the SEI, whose work research focuses on big data. And we've spoken with Ian before on other topics related to big data, so this is sort of continuing in that realm. In today's podcast, we're going to be talking about four principles that he has come up with for engineering scalable big data systems. And this is very exciting to me because whenever we can move from the specific to generalized principles that can be applied in multiple contexts, that is huge. It's something that if you're not in research, you may not appreciate just how big it is that we've gotten to this point with big data. So I'm very excited about this. But before we get into that, a little bit about Ian. Ian's research explores issues related to software architecture at scale. This includes designing large-scale data management and analytics systems and understanding the inherent connections and tensions between software, data, and deployment architectures in cloud-based systems. Since earning his doctorate in 1988, he has worked in academia, industry, both Microsoft and IBM have had the benefit of his services, and government-funded R&D labs, including CSIRO, PNNL, NICTA, and since 2013, the SEI. He likes acronyms. He has also authored the book, Essential Software Architecture, which is published by Springer Verilog. Welcome today. Thanks for being here. I'm excited about this.
Thanks, Suzanne. Thanks for inviting me.
So we've done this before, but reintroduce the idea of big data to our audience and understand, sort of help them understand why big data is so important today.
Sure. Yeah, it does seem that most of the solutions to the world's problems can be solved by big data if you listen to the hype that's around at the moment. And you will hear people talk about the Vs, the three or four Vs that are associated with big data, the problems of the volume of the data, the velocity of the data or its rate of change, the variety of the data, the different types of data that you have to analyze, and also its veracity, kind of the integrity of the data, the quality of the data. And all of this is kind of amorphous, but it really comes down to one really simple problem which has caused this paradigm shift from our traditional data processing world to the world of big data. And it's now simply that there's an availability of very large and complex data sets that have become impossible to process with traditional databases right. And data processing techniques. And this has forced us to look at new ways to process this data.
And the fortunate thing is at the same time this evolution has been going on, we're also seeing evolutions in hardware processors and multiprocessor cores and things.
That's right.
So the time is right for us to actually be able to look at this issue of big data in the context of architecture, hardware, et cetera.
Yeah, that's right. There's a fusion of software and hardware here that's needed.
So that brings us to then what are some of the challenges that architects in particular and engineers face in designing and building these systems? Because everything starts with the architecture when you're looking at
data. Very much our perspective is the challenges of building these systems. And if you look at some of the surveys that are around and look beneath the hype, you find that roughly 50 to 60% of all big data initiatives are not succeeding at the moment. And the major influences on this are essentially the lack of skills that are available to deal with the new technologies and the new designs and the new architectures that these systems require. All big data systems are inherently distributed, and they require a whole new set of technologies that will exploit the distributed computing infrastructures that a big data solution needs. And these skills are not widely disseminated across the industry. They simply just haven't had to be addressed before in the problems that most people face. And so this lack of familiarity with the advanced technologies that are available for big data problems is really at the essence of some of the difficulties that we face with big data.
And so that's another reason why having some principles that people can apply that are moving into this area, have at least somewhere to look. It's like, okay, I need to learn about this principle and where do I go for that? So why don't you tell us about those four principles? What's the first one?
Okay, well, first one's actually really intuitively very simple. And it essentially says you can't scale your efforts and costs for building a big data system at the same rate that you scale the capacity of the system. And so let's illustrate this with a simple example from a century or so ago. When the telephone was becoming prevalent in the United States, in the old days, people used to have operators who would operate the switch. So you'd make a call and someone would connect you, manually connect you to the exchange so that you could make your call. And someone estimated that as telephones became common in every household, about 30% of the US population would be working as telephone operators. So this obviously is not scalable, and hence the invention of automated switching systems. And in big data systems, we face exactly the same problem. If I estimate the capacity of my system in terms of maybe the volume of data it's going to store or the amount of processing it's going to carry out is going to quadruple in a year, I'm not going to be very popular with the person who's funding my project if I tell them I have to grow my team by a factor of four in that same year, and the costs to operate the system are going to grow by a factor of four. I have to be smart and I have to introduce efficiencies that mean that I'm maybe growing my costs and effort in some sort of linear way, maybe by 5 or 10%, to deal with this growth of a factor of four.
So you have to find leverage points.
You do, that's
right. And that's got to be a challenge in this arena because it is so new.
Yeah,
so,
and it's got to be a conscious thing that pervades through the design choices that you make. So if you're going to expand your data collection, for example, what's the cost of adding a new node to your database so that you can store more data? If someone has to physically walk in and install a system and copy data around, this is a really expensive thing to do. You need to just automatically install a node and the data just moves automatically to there.
So some of the kinds of data processing conventions that were sort of the standard way we did things in the past really have to change to allow for that capacity not to be a linear kind of function with the big data that you want to, volume that you want to deal with.
Yeah, these things simply don't hold anymore. And so you really have to seek out these efficiencies to ensure that your costs grow as slowly as feasible and your capacity grows as fast as requirements dictate.
Okay, and so that leads us to what is the second principle then?
Second one's very much tied to the issue of the technological complexity that big data systems require. There's a huge landscape of solutions from databases to analytical software and stream processing that people can use for building big data systems. And of course, this is all made more complicated by the marketing information that vendors give you and the hype behind many of the open source technologies. And so it's a really difficult place for a team to navigate through this technological space to choose the right solutions. So at the heart of the problem is that you've got to understand that the more complex a solution, the less it will scale. So simplicity is essential for scaling. This is why, for example, we've seen the introduction of weak consistency models in databases that have replaced the strong consistency models that are prevalent in relational databases. Strong consistency is a great thing to have, but it's expensive and it's difficult to implement in a distributed, scalable system. Weak consistency enables us to scale our data much more efficiently. Of course, there's costs and trade-offs to make that you have to maybe embed more application logic to handle this weak consistency. But essentially, weak consistent problems will scale better than strongly consistent solutions.
So you're talking about satisficing solutions. I'm not going to get perfect consistency. I need to have just enough consistency in the case of this attribute to meet whatever the need is for that application, that business function that I want to provide.
Yeah.
And when we're talking about a lot of the function of big data is to provide us with sort of aggregate views of things, one of the aspects of big data is that at a certain point, a lot of these consistency issues actually are sort of taken up in the law of large numbers. So you can afford to have less consistency,
or other attributes you may be able to satisfy on. So simplicity, reducing the complexity, it's really not just about not introducing it, but reducing complexity of current approaches is part of that principle.
Yeah, sure. And same, we see it with processing of big data. Many people are using Hadoop now. And I think many don't realize that Hadoop is a batch processing system. You fire up an Hadoop job, and when it finishes, it's dependent on so many factors that it's not going to finish quickly. Mm-hmm. And so if you need fast responses from your data, Hadoop really probably isn't the solution.
Right.
But there are other solutions that you can look at. You've just got to choose carefully and wisely. And when you're met with a conflict on a decision, think about the underlying principles, about what's happening in that mechanism, and choose the simplest if you want to scale.
Okay. That actually applies to a whole lot of life, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Principles are like that.
What about the third principle? What comes next?
The third one's concerning state management. Many people who build systems are used to using frameworks such as Hibernate or JEE, which promotes, when you query a database, they will create things called stateful objects within your middle tier, within your business logic. And these things are super convenient for programming because all of the data that you need to satisfy the set of queries that a user's going to submit is already in memory. You can quickly access it. You don't have to go to the database. But when you start to scale things, statefulness is a real problem because it's really hard to balance the load of these stateful objects across the available servers. It's difficult to handle failures. Because if you lose your state, what do? You have to somehow reproduce it.
Right.
It's difficult to scale systems by just adding resources because you've got all this state lingering around in your system. So the simplest solution, again, tied back to the second principle, is to use stateless objects and stateless techniques, whereby a request comes in and you somehow retrieve the data, either from a database initially or maybe from some sort of caching mechanism that you have.
An intermediate.
Yeah. And you store some of the state in your client and send it with every request. But this means any of your services can handle any request at any time. There's no state that routes them to specific servers and makes your architecture much more difficult to scale, especially in the face of failures.
But that actually has a lot of implications for programming practices.
It does.
In the database arena. So this is one that, especially for programmers who come out of, I'll call it traditional data processing, they've got to not just relook at the architecture, but relook at the implementation practices
to
achieve that.
And look at how these frameworks promote statefulness and avoid it, probably.
Yeah. And one more, we got four, so what's the last one?
The fourth one's kind of tied to some of the work that is going on in some of the big internet companies and the lessons that have been learned. That as we build these very large systems, two things especially become really hard to implement. The first is that you will have failures in your system, so the more nodes, the more hardware you have, the more software you have, just the law of averages is going to dictate that things will fail. And you have to handle this. And the bigger your system, the more things will fail. So failures become common.
Right. We also call them normal failures.
Yeah,
We have to account for normal failure.
Yeah.
We don't like that term. And we don't like to think about that, but that's really what you're saying,
yeah,
is that failure
that's
is a normal part of dealing with volumes of data at this scale.
Yeah. And the second one's a really thorny one because you can build all these test cases for your code and generate really good synthetic test data and test really thoroughly your system. But as soon as you deploy your system, the volume of data that it's working on will grow way beyond the envelope that you've tested. And hence, how do you know that your test cases and the actual code that you've built is going to work anymore? The answer is you don't, and you never will. So the only feasible solution to these things is to build in what's become called in the industry observability, essentially what we used to call monitoring. But observability is much more than just monitoring. It's the ability to pull data out about your system, both at the application layer and the system layer, and aggregate this data so that operators and developers can gain insights into the behavior of the system at runtime. And so when failures occur, they may be warned about them in advance because you see decay in certain mm-hmm. functions. And it's very easy to look at your code, understand where inefficiencies are, and then work towards streamlining the solution. But without this observability, you just can't build these systems because they will fail in unexpected ways and you will have no idea how to fix them.
And that's a clear architectural implication.
Absolutely.
Because you cannot have observability if you don't plan for that in
yeah.
your architectural choices.
Yeah.
So that is another area where if you're not accustomed to dealing with big data, you're likely to miss that
yeah.
as one of your architectural trade-offs that you're making. How much observability do
yeah.
I need, can I afford, in comparison to other attributes?
And observability is a really thorny one because it very quickly becomes a big data problem in itself. We've talked to some internet.
Yeah.
We talked to some internet companies, and they manage literally 500,000 data points a second. And this is an amazing number. Some manage many more than that. And this all has to be logged and aggregated. And these low-level measures really don't mean very much by themselves. You have to actually process them and build up measures that mean something to a developer or an operator.
Right, so that you can develop triggers.
That's
what you're really looking
automated
for.
Automated triggers as
that
one.
Yep. Highlight that you need to be looking at this part of the system
exactly.
or that part of the system for decay and other
yeah.
issues.
So observability is a really tricky one, and it becomes even trickier because there's really no out-of-the-box solutions that can help people right now.
So is that an area that you're researching in terms of how do we improve observability practices? Because I can tell you right now, I don't have a set of observability
yeah.
practices in my sort of mental model of how you architect systems.
Yeah, that's an area that myself and my colleague John Klein intend to look at in next year's funding. The ability to create a customized observability framework that's got the ability to measure just the measures you want from your application so that you can streamline the measurement, streamline the aggregation, and get effective visualizations of what's going on is an area that we want to start to build tools to help organizations very quickly be able to put these observability solutions together.
But there's sort of a layering that's implied there, because if I have sort of that first layer of here's the essential things, if I get indicators out of that there's a problem, I kind of want to have that next layer of detail
yeah.
available that I can look at and say, well, if it's over here, now I want the data that relates to this in particular. So this
that's
is
right.
not just a single framework
no.
problem. It's going to be, you're going to have some fun.
This is a framework, it's a data storage engine, it's a set of visualization techniques,
yeah.
and it's also the ability to customize, because, you know, organization A is going to have very different observability needs to organization
sure.
B, because their applications are different. It's very hard to pull something out of the box and make it work for both organizations.
Yeah. And you're also starting to see more COTS-based big data kinds of things. Now you've got a different kind of observability issue, because now I have essentially a black box.
Yeah.
So how do I deal with that? So that's another, I'm giving you more research questions, aren't I?
All hard ones, I'm afraid.
I'm really good for that. Okay, well, it sounds like you're going to be busy, and I'll get to talk to you in a few more months, I think, and hear about how some of these things are going. I think everything you've said makes great sense to me, so that's wonderful for me. I don't have to work in these areas. I was thinking about my brother. I have a brother who worked in big data in the mortgage industry at one point, and remembering some of the complaints that he was talking about, they relate directly, especially to that observability principle of trying to detect failures. So
yeah.
I think you've done us all a great service by trying to think about these things.
Well, hopefully we'll have some solutions one day.
Well, this is a start. If you can, you know, you're not the only one that has to think about how these principles are implemented, and getting people to think about how they do this stuff is one of the ways you start sharing that in the community, and we all learn. So,
and I'd love to hear from other people who have other principles, because I'm sure
there
there's more.
There you go. There's an invitation. Maybe a little blog activity would be in order. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Ian. For more information on the approach that Ian and John have developed, please check out his recent blog post at blog.sei.cmu.edu. Click on Ian Gorton's name, that's Gorton, in the author category. This podcast is available on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts.
and on the Carnegie Mellon University's iTunes U site. As always, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email us at info@sei.cmu.edu. Thank you for listening.